Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin our reading of this week's Triangle Business Journal on the biz page. And under the heading of Big Night comes the article, Pro Golfers and Business Execs Lend Hand to First Tee Event. First Tee of the Triangle Executive Director Brendan Baker sure knows how to put a charity event together. Flanked by local business power brokers such as Wyrick Robbins, Larry Robbins, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina CEO Dr. Patrick Conway, Paragon Bank founder Bob Hatley, and some 300 other notables, Baker paired the Triangle Biz community on October the 10th at the Angus Barn Pavilion with some of the legendary professional golfers such as David Toms, Larry Mize, and Scott McCarron playing in the PGA Champions Tour. The event raised more than $100,000 in selling off auction items in less than 2 hours. Biz sat beside Spain's Miguel Angel Jimenez, also known as the most interesting man in golf. And boy, did he have things to say about the recent Ryder Cup, where the European team thrashed the Americans. Our team members like each other. We truly look out for each other, Jimenez said with his thick yet convincing accent. Other team, not so much. Jimenez should know. He's been a member of two victorious Ryder Cup teams. The evening also showcased experiences by young kids in the First Tee curriculum, who are in the program to acquire life skills to become better citizens, character traits that go far beyond golf. And under the heading of Yum comes the article, This is One Kick in the Face You'd Love to Have. It's North Hills' version of the Food Network show Man vs. Food, and it's happening at 4100 Restaurant inside the Renaissance Hotel on October the 21st, when the restaurant hosts its Pumpkin Cheesecake Eating Contest on National Pumpkin Cheesecake Day. Executive chef Kevin Smith will cook the hot cheesecake, and whoever eats the most in 10 minutes will receive a $25 gift certificate to North Hills, a $100 gift certificate for 4100 Restaurant, and have their photograph mounted on a wall inside the restaurant. And while we're talking about food, here's the article, Numbers Show How Big Beer Is in NC. The beer business is booming nationwide, and the Triangle is no exception. The U.S. Census Bureau just released a handful of amazing stats on the craft beer industry. Every state, and just over a quarter of the nation's 3,143 counties, have at least one brewery. In fact, almost 400 counties that had at least one brewery in 2016 did not have a single one in 2012. The Triangle is home to 59 breweries, according to ncbeerguys.com. Of those, a whopping 47 came into existence since 2012, and another 24-plus are set to open. In 2016, the states with the highest number of breweries were California with 368, Colorado with 204, Washington 162, New York 152, and North Carolina 129. One reason for the craft beer explosion, according to Dave Tollefson of the NC Beer Guys, is that North Carolina laws for breweries are a lot easier than those in surrounding states in the Southeast. That's due in part to the fact that the state allows self-distribution up to 25,000 barrels per year and allows the breweries to sell their own beer in their tap rooms. This may not seem like a big thing, but other states had or still have issues with this, he says. Combine that with lower real estate costs, repurposing old factories and mills, which are abundant in the state. Here's a profile of beer drinkers in North Carolina according to the Census Bureau. 51.4% are male, 48.6% female. Median age, 38.3. Median household income, $48,256. Annual payroll per employee, $40,562 per year. Bachelor's degree or higher, 29%. And still in the food and beverage category, under the heading of Good Stuff, comes the article, Local Chocolatier Snares International Attention. Carrie Chocolatier, Grace Stocker, that can compete with the best in the world, and she has awards to prove it. Stocker and her company, Chocolat Grace, make chocolate bonbons from a small shop adjacent to her father-in-law's residence. She beat 1,200 entries from 45 countries in 2018 to bag the Best of the Best trophy from the Academy of Chocolate in the UK. Stocker won 3 gold awards and the Golden Bonbon Award. Stocker makes all her chocolates in small batches using Grand Cru chocolate couvertures, that's pure chocolate, along with fresh products from local farmers. And under the heading of Digging In comes the article, NC Museum Scramble After Florence Damage. From the NC Department of Natural and Cultural Resources comes another Hurricane Florence rescue story. The torrential rains from the storm caused the roofs of 2 eastern North Carolina museums to fall, threatening 2 collections of historical artifacts. The Core Sound Waterfowl Museum in Harkers Island and the Indian Education Program Museum in Pembroke both experienced significant issues, leading to water damage and mold that has impacted the collections of both facilities. Enter the Cultural Resources Emergency Response Team, or CREST. The team of employees from the State Department of Natural and Cultural Resources, along with regional partners, is working with both museums to clean and restore hundreds of artifacts, find temporary off-site storage for the Core Sound Museum's collection, and assist in preparing some of the Indian Education Program Museum's printed materials for digitization. And finally, on the biz page, under the heading Band Battle, comes the article, These Brokers Know How to Party for a Good Cause. Jim Anthony donned a flame-retardant space suit and took the stage at the Lincoln Theater in Raleigh on a recent evening, not to serenade clients, but to raise money for a good cause. With a band behind him, the real estate broker, who also happens to be CEO of Colliers International Raleigh, played an entire David Bowie set to the delight of the 500-person crowd at the Triangle Area Office Building Association's annual Battle of the Broker Bands contest. 6 groups played throughout the night, each taking the stage, for 25 to 30 minutes. The bands, oh man, the bands were fantastic, says Brian Farmer, broker with Trademark Properties, and the TRAOBA board member who organized the event. The brokers brought their A game. When the dust settled, HFF's John Mickles and his band carried home the first place trophy. But the real winners were the Triangle Down Syndrome Network and the Multiple Sclerosis Society, which received a combined $16,000 raised from the event that took place October 4th. Next, we move to the Tech and Transportation page of this week's journal. And under the heading of Cashing Out comes the article, Top Inside Stock Sales of Q3 in the Triangle. From McVia to Red Hat to Bandwidth, insiders at Triangle companies continued to rake in millions in the third quarter by selling shares, U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission filings show. In the third quarter, there were 14 separate filings disclosing sales worth more than $1 million. Of those, 7 involved executives with ICVIA ties, particularly John Denhockey, a director at the firm since 2016, whose name was on 4 of the filings. One of those was for a $52.3 million share sell-off September 14. Of the 14, 8 involved life sciences companies such as Transenterix, whose board member, William Starling, sold $22.7 million in shares September 27. Here's a look at the individual inside stock sales that broke at least $10 million in the third quarter. There's Ari Bousbib, CEO of ICVIA, sold shares valued at more than $54.6 million. John Donahue, director, sold $52.3 million in shares of ICVIA Holdings. Again, Donahue, director, sold $46.2 million shares on September 12th. Another Donahue for $28.1 million in shares of ICVIA on September the 12th. And one more, Donahue, a director, sold ICVIA shares valued at $28.1 million on September the 10th. William Starling, Jr., director, sold $22.7 million in shares of Transenterix on September 27th. James Bowen, longtime investor, sold $14.7 million in shares of Bandwidth on August the 10th. And finally, Jim Whitehurst, CEO of Red Hat, sold shares valued at more than $11.5 million on August the 8th. And under the heading of Changes Plan comes the article, NC finally ready for upgrades on busy I-95. After years of planning, yet little action, I-95 is about to double its lanes in the state, as the NC Department of Transportation is nearly ready to invest $700 million to widen the roadway. Officials hope improvements will give the region a much-needed economic development boost. NCDOT plans to award a contract next spring to a design and construction team that will widen I-95 from 4 lanes to 8 lanes between Exit 56 in Cumberland County and Exit 71 in Harnett County. In 2020, another contract will follow, further expanding the freeway between Exits 71 and 81 in Benson, where I-95 and I-40 converge. It will be the first major upgrade since the highway was built in the 1950s. Widening the road from 4 to 8 lanes is a complex job. At least 6 interchanges and overpasses will have to be rebuilt with taller, longer bridges. Greg Burns, NCDOT Division Engineer, says that if all goes as planned, work could begin as soon as next summer. And under the heading of Complicated Issue comes the article, What You Need to Know Before Riding a Scooter. With Bird scooters emerging in downtown Raleigh and Durham, liability questions take flight as riders collide with private property, only to find themselves uninsured. It's a situation Cary resident AFWORK Shuramu knows from the other side. He was driving a Toyota on Fayetteville Street on August 29th when, according to the Raleigh police, he hit a rider on a motorized Bird scooter who had turned onto a pedestrian crosswalk. The driver of the scooter was at fault in the incident and uninsured, the police determined. Shuramu alleges the scooter's driver, listed in the report as Defonte Douglas of Raleigh, has yet to pay for the $1,500 in damages to the car. Douglas didn't respond for comment. In Bird's liability waiver, the company warned riders to check with their insurance providers. Automated insurance policies may not provide coverage for accidents involving or damage to this vehicle, the waiver on its website states. Hoyd Tessener, a litigation attorney with the law offices of James Scott Farron, says it's a complicated issue for drivers such as Shuramu, but especially for scooter riders. While traditional car insurance coverage will apply to a driver when a vehicle is at fault in a scooter collision, it doesn't work the same way with scooter riders. I don't believe motor scooters fit in any category, so as a result, I don't see that there's any insurance company in North Carolina covering someone riding a motor scooter, he says. Now we turn to the real estate page of this week's journal, and the major article on this page is under the heading of Downtown Raleigh, Office Tower, Part of Next Phase for Development at Peace and West Streets. With the land assemblage now complete, developers behind the Peace and West project in downtown Raleigh have laid out the details of Phase 2, including a 225,000-square-foot office tower and a timeline that involves breaking ground next summer. The property spans just over 3.5 acres, immediately south of Phase 1, a 12-story mixed-use project anchored by a Publix grocery store. Construction is currently underway at the site, including a new road that has been cleared south of the development. The project is expected to open in the summer of 2020, but that hasn't stopped developer Kane Realty Corporation and its partner Williams Realty and Building Company from charging ahead with the next phase called Smoky Hollow, after the historic name of the area. Kane Realty President Mike Smith says the plan is to build an office building in the 10-story range, in addition to 280 residential units and as much as 50,000 square feet of ground floor restaurant and retail space, all of it surrounding a courtyard. The firm is currently preparing to submit a site plan to the city, with plans to begin construction in the summer of 2019. That would be about 12 months prior to the completion of Phase 1, Smith says, meaning both projects would be underway at the same time for about a year. The broader goal of the next phase, according to Smith, is to create a sense of place and link the new development to neighboring Glenwood South. The pedestrian connectivity is a key focus of ours, making it feel integrated with the neighborhood, he says. In the meantime, the developers have been plodding along with preparations for the third and final phase of the larger build-out. In late September, they bought yet another parcel to add to their land holdings for future development next door, this time paying $1.7 million for the last half-acre parcel of what is now another 3.5-acre assemblage. We believe that Phase 3 has a lot of opportunity for great density, being right there at the entry to the city and along Capitol Boulevard, Smith says. He also noted the city's development of nearby Devereaux Meadows Park on the north side of Peace Street. But don't expect activity on the site anytime soon. Smith says the development team plans to wait until the first two phases of the project are complete and open before beginning construction. The ongoing development is one of several projects Crane Realty is juggling at the moment. Also in the works is a rezoning request that would allow the firm to build up to 20 stories on property across from the new Union Station in the Warehouse District. Also under the heading of real estate comes Zillow picks Raleigh for the new home buying service. Beginning this winter, Raleigh residents will be able to buy and sell their homes through Zillow. The online real estate database company announced October 8th an expansion of its nascent Zillow Offers service to the City of Oaks and Charlotte. The two additional locations push the company's footprint for this new service to 6 metro areas, including Atlanta and Denver, poised to launch later this month. Zillow is the latest company to jump into the growing real estate technology industry known as iBuying. An entire ecosystem of startups has emerged in recent years, offering consumers easier ways to buy and sell their homes, often employing technology to help price homes and make offers to owners. Perhaps the most well-known is Open Door, a San Francisco company founded in 2014. The company launched in Raleigh in February and has purchased more than 500 homes across the Triangle since then, according to real estate records. On the surface, Zillow Offers and Open Door have similar tactics. Both allow homeowners to fill out paperwork online and receive a cash offer from the company within a few days. The companies then turn around and sell the home. Open Door will pump money into repairs. Both charge fees along the way, similar to typical real estate agents. Selling a home isn't exactly difficult in the Triangle, where the average day's home spends on the market continues to go down as demand for housing remains strong. But the companies insist they make the process so easy that many consumers still prefer to forego the hassle. And in other real estate news comes the heading Changing Course, and the article is entitled Wegmans Delays Plans for Triangle Locations. Shoppers in Cary and Chapel Hill will have to wait a bit longer to peruse the aisles of Wegmans. Both cities have seen the timelines pushed back for the much-loved New York grocery chain to open. In Cary, developers have delayed and shrunk the size of a Wegmans being built at the new Twin Lakes Center on the west side of town, reducing it from 130,000 square feet to 103,000. The change, approved by the Cary Town Council, was made with larger trends in the grocery business in mind. More people are seeking out home delivery or ordering ahead of time and doing curbside pickups, Wegmans project manager Steve Leety told the council. The size reduction also comes as other grocers have stumbled in the Triangle market and other markets. Lidl has backed out of plans for a store in Cary and two other North Carolina locations, while Kroger has shuttered all of its Triangle stores. Two other Wegmans are being built in the Triangle, the location on Wake Forest Road, being built at a Regency Center shopping complex, is supposed to open next year. Another Wegmans will be at the new Fenton project across from Cary Town Center. The smaller footprint isn't all bad news for shoppers. The change has cleared the way for more outdoor seating space, in particular, in the area next to the groceries market, says Howard Kaufman, CEO of Leyland Alliance, the firm building the shopping center. With the changes has come a delay in the construction timeline, which is now expected to be complete in mid-2020 rather than late 2019. Kaufman anticipates other buildings at the complex will open late next year. Wegmans typically opens 3 stores per year. Next year, the new locations will be in Virginia Beach, Virginia, Brooklyn, New York, and on Wake Forest Road in Raleigh, Wegmans spokeswoman Joe Natal says. In Chapel Hill, the city and county backed the development of a new Wegmans with a $4 million incentive package approved in 2016. But Orange County Economic Development Director Steve Brantley says Wegmans notified city and county officials in September that construction has been delayed 6 to 8 months. And under the heading of Wake County Push comes the article, Duke Health Plans Major New Campus for Cary. As Duke University Health System continues to expand its presence in Wake County, the organization is moving forward with plans for a sprawling new medical campus in Western Cary that could total close to 1 million square feet. The complex of offices and specialty care clinics would rise on property that lines both sides of Green Level West Road, just off the NC 540 interchange. Duke Health acquired the nearly 70 acres over the past 2 years and has submitted a rezoning application to the town of Cary. We're expanding our health care all over Wake County, says Scott Selig, Duke's off-campus real estate executive. The Cary campus is part of a larger push that includes a new Duke Health Center in Wake Forest and a 72,000-square-foot building ready to open in Holly Springs. This is just another piece of the puzzle, he says. The land is currently zoned residential, but the proposed land use changes would allow up to 750,000 square feet of medical office space, in addition to 250 residential units, 250 hotel rooms, and another 55,000 square feet of other commercial space. Part of that would include a $34 million ambulatory surgical center with 4 operating rooms, according to a Certificate of Need application submitted by Duke Health to the NC Department of Health and Human Services. Under the proposed zoning change, Duke Health would be creating a new urban center in an otherwise rural corner of Cary, which would be a significant change in character that also happens to be in line with the town's long-range plan for the area. The master plan that's supposed to guide future development in Cary classifies this section of town as a destination center. According to documents filed with the town by Duke Health, more of the office development would take place north of Green Level West Road. Residential uses would only be permitted south of the road, but a grid of streets and a few bike lanes would fan out throughout the campus, connecting the various nodes of development. The proposed zoning changes would require development to be denser along major roads. Buildings that front Green Level West Road would have a minimum height requirement of at least 3 stories. Town council members have compared the size of the proposal to the 2.5 million square foot Fenton mixed-use project being developed by Columbia Development Group across from the Cary Town Center. The project received a rezoning approval in January after 2 years of planning and months of discussion among Cary leaders and residents. Next, we turn to the On Healthcare page of this week's TBJ. And under the heading of expensive comes the article, Rising Costs of Healthcare, Rising Costs of Health Insurance Outpace U.S. Wage Growth. Employer-sponsored health insurance costs rose again this year, bringing the family averages close to $20,000 and individual costs to nearly $7,000, largely as a result of increasing health care costs. According to a Kaiser Family Foundation report, annual family premiums for employer health insurance rose 5% from 2017 to $19,616 per year, marking the 7th straight year of cost increases. Individual coverage rose 3%, averaging $6,896. The foundation says 57% of employers offer health benefits, resulting in 152 million American citizens relying on employer-sponsored coverage. According to a foundation survey, nearly half of employers that do not offer benefits to employees cited rising costs as a reason. Health costs don't rise in a vacuum. As long as out-of-pocket costs for deductibles, drugs, surprise bills, and more continue to outpace wage growth, people will be frustrated by their medical bills and see health costs as huge pocketbook and political issues, KFF President and CEO Drew Altman said in a release. On average, employees are contributing $5,547 per year for family coverage and $1,186 toward individual coverage. Since 2008, the average premiums have increased by 55% and wages 26%. Additionally, 85% of covered employees have a deductible in their coverage plan, a 4% increase from the year prior, and 59% increase from a decade ago. The average single deductible now stands at $1,573. The average deductible in 2008 was $735. The foundation estimates that these factors have resulted in a 212% increase in burdens of deductibles on covered employees. The survey also asked employers to predict how the 2017 tax law elimination of the Affordable Care Act's tax penalty against the uninsured would affect future enrollment. Of the firms questioned, 10% of all and 24% of larger firms said they expect fewer enrollments in the coming year. And another major article from this week's page comes the heading Cameron Village, and the article is Wake Med to Develop Raleigh Building. Residents and visitors of Cameron Village may soon be able to add visiting a physician to their list of things to do in the Raleigh Shopping Center. On October the 9th, Wake Med announced plans to redevelop the property at 505 Oberlin Road into a medical office building. Plans for the building, directly across from the Harris Theater, include primary and urgent care, among other outpatient offices. Wake Med Physician Practices will anchor the building. A Raleigh landmark, Cameron Village is a great example of a neighborhood transitioning to a walkable community where essential services, including schools, offices, shopping, parks, public transportation, and now healthcare, will be readily available, stated Tom Cavender, Vice President of Facilities and Construction with Wake Med Health and Hospitals. The existing office building on the property currently houses a U.S. Post Office branch, Edward Jones Investments, NC Council of Community MHDDSA Programs, Hidden Stream Counseling, U.S. Marine Corps Officer Selection Office, the Autism Society of North Carolina, and Maddox Coins and Stamps. Wake Med is an exciting addition to the Cameron Village neighborhood, said George York, President and CEO of York Properties. We strive to make the village a truly complete community serving all our residents and customers. The offices are scheduled to open by mid-2020. Next, we reach the cover story of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and it's entitled Chasen's Next Chapter. Michael Chasen has a story he likes to tell. In it, he's a savvy, though eager, technology entrepreneur pitching his new company, Precision Hawk, to a venture capitalist. It's a drone software company, Chasen tells him. We want to focus on the analytics and machine learning, and that has good margins, he says confidently. Well, that's how we're going to scale and grow internationally. The VC leans back in his chair. Michael, that's ridiculous, he says. You want to be a services company. That way, he could hire drone pilots to collect data, then hire consultants from Greater Washington's deep talent pool at $100 an hour, but bill them out at $200. But hey, the VC says, good luck with your software company. Chasen heads to another meeting across town, sits down with VC number two, and then spools his pitch again. Precision Hawk, he says, is a drone services company, like an IBM or Oracle, practically giving away the software, but yielding larger service contracts. The margins will be great. Still, no interest. Michael, VC number two says, you need to be a product company. Cue laughter. The audience for this particular telling was the InterDrone 2018 Industry Conference, held last month in Las Vegas, where Chasen gave the keynote. He used the story to illustrate the state of his current industry, in flux, deciding where to place its bet, figuring out how to craft business models, seeing how key pieces of federal regulation play out. But Chasen has told the same story before. He used it at a tech conference as recently as last year to describe his first company, Blackboard. That company went from a D.C.-based software startup launched by some college friends to a cornerstone Greater Washington Tech Services brand and dominant e-learning platform. It was acquired by private equity for $1.7 billion. Chasen followed the same pattern yet again with Social Radar, though that time with more mixed results. It's all informing his path forward in his next evolution as a tech executive in an industry he's never worked in, at a company 6 hours from his Bethesda, Maryland home, Precision Home, Precision Hawk of Raleigh. And what all of the stories seem to conclude is this. Chasen, who also has a home in Raleigh, a quick study, hungry to learn, able to adapt. People who know him say that's what sets him apart as an entrepreneur. The key thing people should know about Michael is that he's not just entrepreneurially driven, but he's a very, very curious person, says Matthew Patinsky, who with Chasen, Daniel Kane, and Stephen Gilfus co-founded Blackboard in the late 1990s. It very quickly made sense for him to jump into a different industry, to a certain extent, a different business model, and be able to take the experience he had scaling Blackboard into a very different context. I know that's part of what he was looking for, to learn and continue to grow. Even with Precision Hawk, Chasen is leaning on his Blackboard experience. Chasen and Patinsky left their jobs as education consultants with KPMG in 1997 and teamed up with a group of Cornell University programmers who had developed course management software. They set out to sell a learning management system. That's a platform for a host of teaching, learning, and administrative functions at a time colleges and universities weren't using such things. In fact, the first five schools we asked said no, Chasen says. First of all, they said the teachers are Luddites. They'll never put their course materials online. Second of all, it's probably against the policy of the school to put grades up online where people can access it. And third, the students aren't even asking for it, so no, no, no. But we were like, wow, if this takes off, everybody's going to be using this technology. Chasen at the time was a raw talent, says Roger Novak, co-founder of Bethesda-based venture capital firm Novak Biddle Venture Partners, and an early financial backer and Chasen mentor. He grew from someone who was ego-driven and wanted to get his hands into everything to a polished leader who learned to delegate, could effectively manage a board in ways beyond his years, and become a good listener, even when his board micromanaged him, and every month he hit his numbers. By the end, I would tell you I thought Michael was just a real crackerjack CEO, Novak adds. We had to let him run. Novak remembers one time in particular that really tested Chasen's chops. Around 2002, before the company went public, Blackboard was readying a product release for its 30 largest customers, but the software was buggy. The quality assurance testing took into account a 20% growth in usage, but not the exponential spike in users Blackboard was seeing at campuses across the country, as students posted several times a day on message boards and professors streamed bulky video files. It was riddled with problems. After a come-to-Jesus meeting with the board, Chasen, Patinsky, and other senior executives literally went out to the schools and said, "What can we do to make this right?" Novak recalls. Chasen took control of the product development team, moving his office to that floor to be closer to the staff, and leading weekly product releases until all the problems were fixed. A couple of years before that, the upstart company hit one of its toughest roadblocks. The tech bubble burst, and precious momentum Blackboard had built was in peril. It had been weighing an initial public offering at that point, a critical move for a young company that wasn't yet profitable and so needed the infusion of cash. Chasen, as CEO, had to institute a series of layoffs, among other moves, to weather the storm. That was a level of fortitude that I had not seen up to this point, Patinsky says. At one point, the company even considered a drastic move. Blackboard mold giving away its software, as so many other tech startups did back then. It stayed the course instead while a dozen competitors all came up with versions for free, Chasen recalls. And then when it blew up, they went out of business. And suddenly, we're doing $40 million in revenue and breaking even. Blackboard IPO'd in 2004. and by 2006 commanded 70% of the LMS market. It aggressively snapped up competitors to fuel that growth. At its peak, it topped $500 million in revenue and boasted a market cap of almost $2 billion. Ultimately, it came to be seen in the EdTech space as a bit of a Microsoft-like incumbent, overly dependent on legacy software licenses and enterprise installs, slow to recognize the emergence of open-source startups and software as a service, and, like Microsoft, a vocal contingent of Blackboard customers grew quite critical of the company's products and user experience, though its sales continued to climb every year. Providence Equity Partners acquired Blackboard in 2011 for $1.7 billion, and the jury's out on what kind of job the Rhode Island firm has done with the investment, which is on its second CEO since that sale. Cornell University, Blackboard's first customer, said in the spring it was taking its education software business to a rival. Then reports surfaced that Blackboard's debt had taken a hit, with some of the bonds selling at distressed levels after months of contract losses and diminishing market share. This summer brought even harsher news from Michael Feldstein, an EdTech analyst with MindWires Consulting. For the first time ever, Canvas eclipsed Blackboard as the most popular learning management system for U.S. colleges and universities. This is a stunning development for a company that seemed to have established an unbreakable market dominance a decade ago, Feldstein wrote. Chasen views the Blackboard exit as a success and is diplomatic about the company's current ownership. In terms of global penetration, he says, Blackboard is still the largest multi-learning provider. He's also philosophical about the challenges Blackboard, or any mammoth tech company, face with cheaper, more nimble competitors. Blackboard had gotten to be such a large company. You then have lots of small companies that are able to eat at your heels. So you're going to lose market share over time, he says. And then you run into the innovator's dilemma. And I think that was the challenge that Blackboard ended up facing. We had large, monolithic software, and then pure software-as-a-service competitors come and compete against us. The experience taught him how to run several different kinds of companies at once, not just one focused on e-learning software, but also half a dozen data centers, a student ID commerce business it had acquired, a mobile division, and a consulting group. I ended up getting expertise in software, subscription software, hosting, support, consulting, hardware, mobile. I had the opportunity of learning the gamut of all these businesses, Jason says. I think I have a pretty deep bench of all the different core components that could be included in a technology company. When Chasen was running Blackboard's mobile division, he saw how students were using apps to connect and find each other. He thought there might be potential in designing an app that would enable people to see the location of their friends, and who else was at that same venue, and Social Radar was launched. It would eventually raise about $12.75 million from venture firms, such as New Enterprise Associates, a blue-chip investor for tech startups. But it didn't take long for the obstacles to start popping up and the identity between software, services, and products to blur once again. The original marketing plan, to launch a consumer app to pull data from social networks to show which users' connections were nearby, ran into trouble when social gaming on Facebook, Farmville anyone, took off. Facebook's social network was seen as a hugely valuable conduit for direct downloads of Social Radar's app. But the popularity of Candy Crush and the like drove the cost per acquisition from $1 per user to $3 per user or more, according to Sheena Glinzer, who headed up marketing for Social Radar after working with Chasen at Blackboard for 8 years. Suddenly, Social Radar's cash to buy hundreds of thousands of users and lots of valuable data on those users wasn't going nearly as far. The market drove us in a direction that no one anticipated, Glinzer says. Add to that the location data undergirding the mapping apps, which Chasen knew was often flawed. So the company shifted to what it saw as a bigger opportunity, developing standalone technologies for GPS location and venue identification for third-party developers to build their own apps. Social Radar in 2014 bought Baltimore-based GridSkipper, which tracked consumer dining, shopping, travel, and banking preferences to help beef up a social development kit it offered for free to app developers, then sold advanced feature licensing and more detailed reporting functions on top of that. There are a whole bunch of ways to monetize this long-term, Chasen told the Washington Business Journal when that acquisition was announced. But that pivot ultimately brought with it hurdles with strategy and scaling. There were several staff departures in late 2015, including the three-person GridSkipper team the company had acquired the year before. Chasen acknowledged a cultural difference between the Social Radar and GridSkipper teams at the time, calling it a challenge, but adding that didn't lead them to leaving. In November 2016, Social Radar was sold to Verizon Communications Incorporated to help bolster the larger company's MapQuest offerings. Terms of the deal were not disclosed, but a source with knowledge of the deal's terms has since pegged the price at about $10 million. Chasen declined to comment on that figure. Chasen insists Social Radar was never envisioned as a billion-dollar idea, and because of that, he doesn't draw lessons in how he's building Precision Hawk. Fundamentally, he said, they're entrepreneurial apples and oranges, but he knows how to handle a startup's many curveballs. I view the exit as a success, but we had obviously hoped for a much higher upside for everybody. But what's harder about a play like Social Radar? We never thought it was going to be big, Chasen says. We always knew with Social Radar that we had this idea for an interesting app or an interesting technology. Fundamentally, it was a small play. People interviewed for this story who know and worked with Chasen don't think he's driven by any sense of vindication given Social Radar's exit, though Novak chuckled when asked about the venture's denouement. Let's just say there are some investors who didn't get their money back, he says. Social Radar, in the end, had introduced Chasen to Precision Hawk. Before selling Social Radar, Chasen was researching LIDAR, which stands for Light Detection and Ranging, and is a remote sensing method that uses light in the form of a pulse laser to measure variable distances to the Earth. He wanted to learn whether it could take exact, millimeter-level measurements of buildings to enhance his company's location tracking. I was thinking of flying a drone over cities to get the exact location of all buildings. Anyways, that's a federal crime, he says, with well-honed comedic timing. Turns out you actually can't do that. Nonetheless, I'm an entrepreneur, and Precision Hawk was one of the first companies that was saying it would actually put LIDAR on drones. A short time later, a recruiter reached out to him about running the company. Its board needed someone to take it to the next level, to build out a sales force, put strong legal and finance functions in place, to craft strategies to build products around its solution. Bob Young, founder of Fortune 500 company Red Hat, was the first investor in Precision Hawk and a board member who ran the company for a time as CEO until Chasen was hired. The company had whittled 30 CEO candidates to 3 when Chasen emerged. His track record of building a market leader in a nascent industry jumped out to a guy who pioneered the open source software industry. Michael was head and shoulders above anyone else we had interviewed. It became blindingly obvious that we had found the right guy, Young says, describing Chasen as aggressive, competitive, strategic. There was no debate at the board level. Chasen flies to Raleigh and is in the office 3 or 4 days a week. The rest of the time, he's on the road meeting with clients or at trade shows or conferences. To Chasen, Precision Hawk was perceived as a market leader, thanks in part to its work with the Federal Aviation Administration on its Pathfinder initiative, a 3-year effort to lay out commercial drone best practices, which the agency did in 2016. He quickly raised $75 million and then acquired 2 companies, Hazon Solutions LLC and Inspect Tools Inc., with deep energy industry customer relationships and subject matter expertise. Hazon has done more than 13,000 inspections, comprising more than 8,000 flight hours for clients including First Energy, Dominion Energy, Duke Energy, and Marathon Petroleum, while Inspect Tools has developed software and analytics for the renewable energy market. Today, Chasen characterizes Precision Hawk with 150 employees and about $100 million in total capital raised but not yet profitable as an aerial intelligence company. It has a network of 15,000 drone pilots collecting data that can be sliced and diced by scientists using the latest analytics and machine learning tools. If you're in agribusiness, Precision Hawk will fly a drone and count your crops, measure the plant canopy cover, look for water damage, spot ladybug infestation. It inspects utility poles and transmission lines for energy companies. It utilizes visual and thermal imagery to get exact measurements at construction sites. It can fly over difficult-to-reach areas and help local governments get critical services back online for residents, as it did after the devastating Hurricane Florence flooding last month in its home state. Precision Hawk is helping one client develop an internal drone division, advising the company on which drones and sensors to buy, developing software, and training pilots. Another customer asked Precision Hawk to fly over its pipeline in Alaska and turn over the data, using algorithms that might predict levels of structural damage and when repairs are needed. Meanwhile, regulatory work continues on an important issue, flying drones beyond a visual line of sight. That, Chasen and others believe, is a key to unlocking the true value of the commercial drone industry, being able to fly them farther than the eye can see. Precision Hawk is one of nine companies that can fly 3 miles, which Chasen estimates is a 1,000% increase in coverage and would generate the cost savings needed for customers to truly embrace the technology. But to do that, systems need to be in place to ensure that drones don't fly in the way of airplanes. That's why Precision Hawk and others are working on things like acoustic-based detection systems, which would pick up the sound of an oncoming aircraft. It's a steep learning curve. Chasen knows from experience that a lot will have to break right. I cannot tell you the insurance, energy, agriculture, and infrastructure space. We're not yet at the point where you look outside and see drones flying around, he says. But in the next few years, we're going to be. So we got to ask, is Precision Hawk a software company or a services company? It's not a products company. It doesn't make drones. I still don't really know which way the market's going to go, Chasen says. But either way, he's betting on drones becoming a huge market in the next year. If he's right, it will make one heck of a story someday. Now we come to this week's executive voice, and that belongs to Jay Lewis. Dan Ryan Builders has been rocketing up the Triangle home building charts in recent years, rising from relative obscurity to rank third overall in new home starts for the region. The company reported $143.5 million in closed dollar volume in the Triangle and built 610 homes locally in 2017, according to TBJ Research. At the helm is Jay Lewis, a 30-year veteran of the home building industry who became division president last year. Lewis has a background both with local and national builders and has helped Dan Ryan Builders grow by harping on a diversified home offering portfolio at affordable price points. Here, Ryan recalls his journey in the home building industry and how to overcome that market's current obstacles. So what was your first job out of college? I worked for Ryan Homes in Northern Virginia as an entry-level construction superintendent. How did you get into the business of building homes? I discovered the industry during an on-campus recruiting event at Villanova University. What first drew you to the Triangle? Everything. The stability of the housing market, the lifestyle reputation, the abundance of higher education, trout streams within a three-hour drive, and the people I was given the opportunity to partner with. So what have been the most significant changes to the industry in the Triangle in the past 5 years? The cost of land and the regulatory environment of land entitlements and development approvals. What do you see as the next great opportunity for home builders? Garner seems to be that place, but Southeast Raleigh in general looks to have an attractive growth trajectory. Also, Fuquay Varina down through Angier and Harnett County will see growth as a result of the 540 extension. So what's the biggest challenge facing home builders today? Just one? The first is talent. We're seeing a severe lack of interested, qualified, and capable people looking to make a career in the industry. Cost in general is a significant concern, but not just sticks and bricks. The cost of raw land, the cost of development, regulatory costs, and the cost of entitlements and approvals is measured in time. So how do you account for the rapid growth of your company? We've maintained an affordable price point in places where people want to live. We've followed our guiding principle of being the best value in home ownership. What keeps you up at night? Thinking of ways to continuously grow and develop our young team in ways that challenge and inspire each of them. How do I convince them all, in word and deed, that this is a fabulous industry that can provide for them beyond their wildest dreams? What books are on your nightstand? The Daily Stoic, April 1865, The Art of Racing in the Rain, Bear, The Life and Times of Augustus Owsley Stanley III. Now we reach the viewpoint page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and the guest columnist is written by Mark Muro and Robert Maxim. Muro is a senior fellow and policy director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. Maxim is a senior research analyst at Brookings who assisted with this report. It's entitled Big Tech's Role in Regional Inequality. The world's most digital nation and its tech titans need to recognize tech's harmful tendency to deepen regional divides and start pushing back on it. With all the economic growth it has spurred, big tech is contributing to rising territorial inequality, and we need to fix it before it's too late. Big tech companies have been blamed for many things lately, whether it be fake news, privacy scandals, and addictive product design, or the rise of inequality and spreading social tensions. The current year has seen the giants of America's digital economy forced to acknowledge their role in a long list of distortions of the real world. It's not been pretty. Yet at the risk of piling on, it's also time to bring up one more major problem, tech's big role in reshaping the nation's urban geography. Some of this is local and well-known, epitomized by the tumultuous livability crises that engulf neighborhoods in Seattle, San Francisco, and other tech hotspots. In Seattle, the hypergrowth of Amazon's downtown HQ has been blamed for spiraling real estate costs, traffic gridlock, and rising homelessness, among other issues. But what is less recognized and much more extensive is big tech's vast influence on the nation's landscape, including on the widening gap between booming coastal tech hubs and smaller cities in the heartland. Scholars have for years suspected that tech might alter the hierarchy of cities, given its bias towards skilled workers. More than a decade ago, researchers Paul Beaudry, Mark Doms, and Ethan G. Lewis showed cities that adopted personal computers earliest and fastest saw their relative wages increase the quickest. Now there's more evidence, including in our own work, that digital technologies are contributing heavily to the divergence of metro economies and the pull away of superstar cities like Boston and San Francisco from more ordinary ones with painful impacts. Now some signs are encouraging. Last year, Apple invested $1 billion in a fund to scale up manufacturing in U.S. communities. Microsoft launched an initiative focused on fostering opportunity in small metro and rural areas. And AOL co-founder and Washington, D.C.-based investor Steve Case launched a $150 million Rise of the Rest seed fund for startups in the Midwest and other overlooked areas backed by a who's who of Silicon Valley luminaries. Next must come more explicit acknowledgments of tech's geography problem, and hopefully significant investments and skill building by big tech in left-behind regions. As for policymakers, they need to acknowledge the dangers of a new national map characterized by too much tech-driven growth in a few places and too little elsewhere. Governments will likely need to intervene directly to ensure the benefits of tech-driven growth are more widely distributed, even while maintaining the efficiency of dynamic clusters. One way to do this at the federal level is for the government to establish a competition through which 10 or so medium-sized cities in the heartland would compete for a major new federal investment and designation as a rising tech pole. Pressure from lawmakers to invest more in the places left behind would also be helpful. This week's editor's notebook is entitled Headwinds Getting Stronger in CRE Financing. If you notice the number of cranes around town, it's hard to imagine that things are about to slow down in the commercial real estate world. As one of the primary economic forces behind the Triangle's fiscal strength, the CRE sector always gives us a glimpse of what may be in the cards for future quarters. So I checked the numbers. In 2004, the Class A office vacancy was 14.53%. As of third quarter this year, Class A office vacancy stood at 7.98%. Tight, tight, tight. That means tenants who want to move to new or newer office buildings in the near future better be ready to pay top dollar for new leases, but that's only half the story. One would think that in a tight office market, there would be more new office buildings in the works. Well, there are. Two of them that immediately come to mind are John Kane's new North Hills Tower and Andy Andrews, that's Dominion Realty, the new Wade 5 building near the PNC Arena. But you look deeper into the development cycle and you'll notice one giant hole in the form of financing. Ask any developer, and they would say financial institutions are reluctant to approve loans unless buildings are 40 to 50% leased before the first brick is laid down. And that equation is beginning to kill or stall deals. Sure, there are companies looking to upgrade on space, but we are also at the peak of the economic expansion. The CRE development process is not a one-year or a two-year cycle. It's about a four-year process from financing to a 100% lease for a new building. If banks are unwilling to make their CRE bets for 2020 or 2021, what are the chances they would approve construction of a 25-story building that comes online in 2021? By the end of 2017, about 3 million square feet was under construction in the Triangle when using numbers from trailing four quarters. As of the quarter ending in September, that number had ballooned up to 3.8 million square feet. Annualize that, and you're looking at about 4 million square feet of new construction, that's office, retail, flex, and warehouse, the best since 2016. But if you look at the CRE loan portfolio of banks, you will notice that the number has either flattened out or has gone down. Fearing higher interest rates, many borrowers actually have started paying their loans before they mature. So the demand for new office buildings may be strong now, but financing to build new things is getting tougher and tougher each day. Developers such as Kane, Highwoods, and Dominion will do just fine with their reputation for making money for their lenders, but for others in the industry, watch out. And closing out this week's program is the Business Survey Pulse. The question is, should Bird Scooters have restrictions in downtown Raleigh? You might be interested to know that 76% say yes, and 24% say no. Well, the music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioservice.org. So long till next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once again, that's 919-832-5138.